Welcome to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 22nd. Today, we're going to bring you a special Trojan implosion coverage, and just stick with us. We put this all together right here, right now, for you, right out there. We're going to go into some news headlines before we begin the whole kit and caboodle. So today, the Senate Intelligence Committee plans to vote on NSA General Michael Hayden's nomination to the CIA tomorrow afternoon. The White House would like to have Hayden sworn in Friday, the same date CIA Director Porter Goss leaves officially. The Senate could approve him before Memorial Day. Hayden supports the Bush administration's warrantless surveillance program that has tapped into Americans' phone records in search of Osama bin Laden and friends.
Condoleezza Rice received an honorary degree from Boston College today. Her visit sparks weeks of protest. The Secretary of State spoke to students about having a commitment to reason, or the ability to challenge established views. 50 or so students standing up in silent protest were drowned out by the standing ovation for Condi. Condoleezza Rice is an expert on Russia and the Cold War. During her tenure as Secretary of State, U.S. relations with Russia have deteriorated to the point that some are calling it a new Cold War.
Today, the Federal Trade Commission said it found no evidence of widespread gasoline price gouging after the wake of Hurricane Katrina. It did, however, find 15 small examples unrelated to any sort of industry plot to drive up gas prices worldwide. The president of the National Petrochemical and Refiners Association says the report appears to vindicate the refining industry's actions post-Katrina. But New York Senator Chuck Schumer criticized the FTC for ignoring what he said was the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Schumer says oil companies engaged in price leadership, setting prices higher than what real competition would merit. Few, however, are talking about the effects of the U.S. loosely threatening with attack another oil-rich country and the effects that and the current wars would have on oil futures.
Senate today signaled overwhelming support for Bush's plan to dispatch National Guard troops to states along the Mexican border. No tour of duty would last longer than 21 days, and troops would be excluded from search, seizure, arrest, or similar activities. The vote was 83 to 10. The agreement came as the Senate debated the most far-reaching immigration bill in two decades. The measure would strengthen border enforcement, create a new guest worker program, and provide an eventual opening for citizenship of many millions of men and women already in the country illegally.
More than 950 Oregon National Guard troops have completed training in Mississippi and will then leave for Afghanistan. The troops will spend a year of training Afghan soldiers. Not since World War II has so many soldiers from Oregon been sent into a combat zone. Since 2002, about 250 Oregon Army National Guard soldiers have deployed to Afghanistan. Two have died. The Oregonians will lead a force of 4,500 troops. Officials say the goal is to prepare Afghan troops to function without direct U.S. or coalition involvement so Americans can come home.
Boeing is rolling out a new line of small bombs designed for use in urban conflicts like the war in Iraq. The 250-pound bombs are designed to make precision strikes while reducing the amount of damage to surrounding buildings and people. Boeing will make the bombs at its factory in St. Charles, Missouri.
The Port of Seattle says a new container carrier will start calling in Seattle next year, the Mediterranean Shipping Company. The port expects Mediterranean Shipping to move over 200,000 containers through Seattle next year, generating more than 300 local jobs.
And as part of Governor Gregoire's order to eliminate 1,000 state jobs in middle management, the Corrections Department has cut 8 prison chaplains. This cut leaves 2 full-time chaplains at the Monroe Correctional Complex and the State Penitentiary at Walla Walla, with 1 chaplain for each of the state's other 12 prisons. And now the official news from Associated Press on what happened this weekend. The demolition crews have destroyed the 499-foot cooling tower at the decommissioned Trojan nuclear power plant. With a rumble, the tower leaned to its side and then collapsed in upon itself, leaving an enormous cloud of dust and a multi-ton pile of rubble yesterday morning. It took 2,792 pounds of dynamite and only a few seconds to bring it down. It eliminated a Northwest landmark and a longtime reminder of the controversy over nuclear energy. Portland General Electric, the utility that owns Trojan, ordered the tower destroyed as part of its decommissioning. Trojan closed in 1993 for financial and safety reasons. It has been gradually decommissioned since then. It remains the state's only commercial nuclear power plant. The tower was a landmark or an icon or an eyesore, depending on who you talk to. After these news headlines, the rest of the newscast will be devoted to special coverage of the Trojan implosion.
And we just did those news headlines. So we'll go straight to a story written by Andy Seaton of how we were all there and what we saw.
All right. I talked before the explosion, I talked to Mark Loazzo, president of the Controlled Demolition Incorporated. He spoke about an implosion, about the implosion, and about his company's work at the World Trade Center in New York.
From a technical standpoint, it's challenging. It's the biggest of its kind in a very highly regulated industry. It's a very robust structure because of its location here in a seismic zone with high winds in Columbia River Valley. There are a lot of eyes in the nuclear industry around the world on this tower because they have structures that are similar that will have to come down once they outlive their usefulness as the decades pass. So there's a lot of technical interest. There's a lot of environmental interest. There's a lot of emotional interest for people that built it, that worked at the plant. It's a confluence of a lot of different emotions and perspectives. Makes it interesting.
And how far is the tower from the spent fuel rods?
Over 900 feet. The Assisi is to the north. We've got a linear array of seismographs going back there to monitor exactly what the vibration is, but it is just a fraction of the vibration would be needed to damage far less robust construction. All the nuclear facilities are very well built, but the vibration is not going to be a problem at all.
The reason this plant was shut down was the cooling system was had cracks in it, so there was radiation leaking through the cooling system. Is there any radiation?
No. In the nuclear industry, this is called a free release structure. There's never been any radiation in it. It's just concrete like the pier we're standing on right here. It's going to come down, be crushed up. The steel will be recycled. The concrete will be recycled. It's a very green job that Portland General has going over there.
And have you measured radiation on site?
We haven't, but we can't go in there unless we have a clearance, and there's nothing in the tower at all. The rest of the facility I know nothing about, just the tower we're working on.
They've announced the plans to demolish the containment building in 2008. Have you heard anything about that?
We're working with another contractor who just got the turbine building over there. The turbine pedestals are also massively reinforced, and we've taken out several of those at nuclear facilities around the country, and I think we're probably going to be working on that just to fracture it to make it easier to get out. The nuclear containment itself is even more heavily reinforced. I think that Portland General will go through its diligence and look for the best way to take it down. It may be that an explosives approach will be useful. I really don't know at this time.
Your company was involved in checking out Ground Zero at the World Trade Center. Can you tell us something about that?
We, about 2 months before 9/11, we took down two 400-foot gas holders for Keyspan, which was Brooklyn Union Gas. And that was the first time the city of New York ever tested their federal emergency management plan. And as a result, we knew the fire marshals, we knew the building commissioners, we knew the emergency management administrators. And immediately after 9/11, I was in my office in Baltimore. We were all down there. And we got a call from the fire department. They were concerned about putting their people out in the debris field to look for survivors and things. And they asked if I would come up to New York and look at the stability of the debris for them, which I did. And I did help them write a plan on moving the debris, how to get it out of Manhattan quickly. That was our only involvement there with regard to the city. We then were asked to assist with some very large pieces of debris that were hung up in a building to the south called Deutsche Bank, and we helped engineer getting that down, and basically that's our only involvement.
AFP reported that you said that you found molten steel in the remains of the WTC-7.
I didn't find it, but there was molten steel in World Trade Center 7. There was a very long fire there. There was also molten steel in the base of, I believe it was Tower 2. I think I saw something on TV about that, where it's a lot like a steel furnace that when they make steel, they have fuel and they confine it and they just cook it for a long time. And they had literally weeks and weeks and weeks where fires apparently burned in the debris and just raised the temperature. Steel melts at a fairly low temperature. It doesn't take that much. It's about 2,700 degrees, and that's not that hot. And when you confine it for a long period of time, I did see something on television where they said that they found that, yes.
During the blast, four KABU members were there. There was John Delderfield, Andy Seaton, myself, and our volunteer, Rabia. She has this to report from the Trojan site.
Trojan Nuclear Power Plant's cooling tower came down in a dramatic cloud of dust Sunday morning. I traveled to Kalama to see the first implosion of a nuclear cooling tower in the United States. I spoke with those who came to witness the destruction of Trojan's cooling tower. What follows are their reactions.
I've always had an interest in seeing what would happen with this reactor and the cooling tower and everything after it was shut down. And I'm actually a little bit disappointed that they aren't keeping it up as a monument.
I just think it's an exciting event, and I'm just here to see a historic event happen.
Well, I was involved in trying to stop the Whoops nuclear plants, and in so doing, back in the late 70s and early 80s, got to be good friends with the folks who were fighting Trojan. But then I was one of the consultants to PGE in the study that led to their decision to not fix the plant and to abandon it in 1992.
Longtime anti-nuclear activist Greg Cafori.
The most important thing out of this event is that people understand that this is a plant that was brought down by human beings. Organized people killed an operating nuclear plant against incredible odds, extraordinarily powerful forces, politically, economically. This thing was a colossus, and it was a menace, and we killed it. And that's a message people need to know.
PGE spokesperson Scott Sims explains what onlookers can expect to see during the tower's implosion.
It's going to be starting at about 7 o'clock this morning. They'll be essentially imploding the Trojan tower and the cooling tower. It's been a long time in the making. We've been laying the plans now for more than a year. And the last few months, it's been a pretty intense amount of work as we've gotten the final stages done here.
Can you describe exactly what will occur during the implosion?
Yeah, during the implosion, there are a series of explosives placed in strategic locations on the tower that will allow it to essentially destabilize a tower and fall in on itself, using gravity really to bring the tower down. And so the tower is going to fall roughly in its footprint. It would almost be like if you could visualize it as a Coke can being stomped on by your foot, it would roughly be falling in on itself. So that's really the role of the explosives, is just to help gravity.
Stay tuned all week for KABU's in-depth news coverage on the history, activism, and ultimately the shutdown of the Trojan nuclear power plant. This is Rabia Yeaman for KABU News.
During the festivities up in Kalama, I spoke with Steve Nichols, the Trojan plant manager for PGE. He talked about the plans for bringing down the containment building, which remained standing after Sunday's blast, and he also talked about the future plans for the site.
What are the plans about the containment building?
Well, we're still working on those. I mean, what we've done is we've taken all the internal structures out of the containment building, so I mean, all the equipment, pipes and valves and pumps and all the concrete has been taken out, so today the containment is just a big hollow structure. And so one of the things we're planning to do is that there's a next step in here, which would be late 2007, 2008, which will be actually to bring it down and decommission it as well, you know, take it apart. And so we're still looking at what the best alternative are for that. So we haven't decided on the means to do that yet. So,
what about the secondary radiation in the structure?
There's very, very, very little. I mean, there might be a little bit of treatment of concrete, but it's well within the background, well within the regulations, and everything else has been cleaned to meet all the release standards, and so it's really essentially in a clean structure. So,
okay, what about the existing spent fuel storage?
Well, spent fuel storage will be on site until we can find a repository, and I don't expect that'll be, I'm not sure what the best estimate would be, somewhere 2025, 2030 or so.
And what about vibration from this blast and any future?
Well, we've looked at it. I mean, part of our bid spec for this was to make sure that any vibration was well within the limits for dry storage. We did studies. We set up a lot of seismic indicators over there today, and we'll be checking that to make sure it's within our limits, and we don't expect to see anything. So,
what are the plans for the site long term?
Long term, of course, the dry storage system will still be there. The rest of it is sort of indeterminate. I guess one of the ideas behind removing all the infrastructure there, the buildings, is to get it ready for another use. So if an opportunity comes up in the future, it'll be ready to go. Well, I mean, it'll be, still it'll be an industrial area. So, it would be an excellent site for a new gas turbine plant or some other opportunity like that. So, like I say, if the opportunity arises, we'd love to be able to reuse the facility or as much as we can. So, but no plans today.
What sort of permits have you had to file with EPA and the PUC?
Well, the decommissioning plan total, it was went through the Energy Facility Siting Council. They approved the decommissioning plan. We've made a presentation with the PUC. They've looked at our proposal. The overall initial decommissioning plan was approved by the NRC. For the activities for the tower, we've worked with DEQ. That's really about it. I mean, FAA and DEQ, and then, of course, all the local agencies on how to bring it down and coordinate and do all those things. So it really wasn't a lot of permits that you had to have.
There's talk about bringing back nuclear power and authorizing new plants. You know, PGE is going to be building a nuclear plant to replace this?
I don't see PGE building one. We always have an integrated resource plan that we try to figure out what resources are available to us in the future. So it's hard to say what's coming in the future. Maybe that you'd buy a part of one somewhere just for the power output, but I don't see PG ever building one to bring a tower down.
And what kind of long-term monitoring is going on around here and water quality and things like that?
Oh, there really is none.
That was Stephen Nichols, plant manager for PGE, and interviewed by me before the blast.
The Oregonian newspaper, through a Freedom of Information Act request, had discovered a federal study that shows Portland General Electric's coal-burning plant near Boardman pollutes more than 10 protected parks and wilderness areas, including Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, and Mount Jefferson. Haze from the plant obscures views as far away as Hell's Canyon on the Idaho border. And Strawberry Mountains near John Day, according to the research. Air in the wilderness areas is supposed to be protected as the cleanest in the nation. The U.S. Forest Service commissioned the analysis and provided a copy to PGE, but so far has taken no action on it. The findings raise the likelihood that PGE will have to install millions of dollars worth of pollution controls on the Boardman plant, which is authorized in 1975, just in time to avoid toughened provisions of the Federal Cleaner Air Act. Federal authorities later admitted in a court case that the early authorization was a mistake. Boardman is now one of only two major coal plants in the West without modern pollution controls, such as scrubbers, and no commitment to add them, said Patrick Cummings, Air Quality Program Manager for the Western Governors Association.
John Delderfield, KBOO's John Delderfield, spoke with several people who were downwind from the blast. Reactions they had were very mixed.
My name is Reverend Phil.
Reverend Phil, did you get to witness the Trojan implosion this morning?
Yeah, I did. That was pretty impressive. That was 500 feet of falling debris in under 5 seconds.
Yeah.
That's fast.
It was fast. Where did you get to watch from?
In Goble, Oregon, which is just about a highway, on Highway 30, it's milepost 41.
Okay.
And pretty remote stretch area, and they had a little tavern out there, and they invited everyone to come out last night, and they still have parties going on right now. They have a bunch of bands. And
so do you think there is any chance that that there was any radiation in the dust or whatever?
I hate to think those kind of thoughts just because I was breathing in so much by being close to it, but I'm guessing it's fairly safe. They have a tendency to try and, people in Northwest are pretty sensitive to that form of energy. And so the idea of nuclear fallout, nuclear winter, would not exactly appeal to many people, and the kind of thing that there's probably people testing for right now, And so I'm not too concerned about that. I mean, particularly not considering there's so many other more inconvenient ways to die. It's a good chance that someone who's going to be driving and listening to this and will crash and die.
Oh, I hope not.
I hope not too, but There's a lot of car crashes.
So, Phil, where you guys were watching from, that cloud came right over you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we got debris coming at us pretty fast, actually. Very fine debris, but it was, maybe not quite a minute later, it was the first wave of debris hit us and made us want to leave.
Yeah.
And it was like all gunking up everyone's cameras. People were like rushing to put their lens caps on and everything.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, people like had beverages. They're trying to close them so they don't, you know, kind of shield their eyes and their noses and mouths.
Okay.
So it was, I wouldn't exactly describe it as panic, but concern at when they actually had realized they were going to be pelted with all that.
Would you please state your name for our listeners?
Oh, Bob Hubbard.
So, Bob, did you get to witness the Trojan implosion this morning?
Oh, absolutely epic. I mean, definitely nothing I've ever seen before, that's for sure.
As far as safety and everything, do you think there's any radiation in the dust?
Oh, I wouldn't know that factually, but you'd have to think to some degree, sure.
Yeah.
I was definitely concerned when the big dust cloud rolled over the top of us.
Yeah.
It was like, wow. And it wasn't some dust. It was a lot of dust.
And where did you travel from, Bob?
From the Vancouver, Washington area.
Okay.
Definitely a good time. A lot of people came to see it.
Really?
Yes.
And you guys were mostly around south of the tower?
Yeah, I guess we'd be considered south of the tower.
Okay.
Probably about 100 of us. Say there's 100 people there watching that thing drop out there on the dock.
Sure,
at least 100
yeah.
people, yeah?
Oh, sure.
Did you folks get to witness the blast
yeah.
this morning?
Yeah, we got up about early on 2 hours of sleep. Walk ourselves on down to the dock. There
yeah.
you go, boom. Sack found, rent.
And it rolled right over you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the dust came over.
Yeah, we took cover in the bus.
So here we are in Kalama, Washington. And could you please state your name for our listeners?
Rachel Johnson.
And did you get to witness the Trojan implosion this morning?
I did.
What did you think of that?
I thought it was pretty neat. I've never seen anything like it before, so it was really cool.
Where did you get to view it from?
I was standing up on the rooftop next door.
As far as safety and everything, do you think there was any radiation in the dust?
I have no idea about that. I've heard different things.
Yeah.
There may have been. It was a nuclear plant, so.
So is that one of the most exciting things to happen around here lately?
Yeah, lately.
That was KBOO's John Delderfield.
And did that dust have radioactivity in it? Well, KBOO brought a Geiger counter. The Geiger counter was from the 50s, an old yellow box that we found in the bowels of the station. We tried to calibrate it, but of course, none of us here are nuclear scientists. The closest we could come to was an old physicist, which Andy is really not anymore. So we really didn't know what we were doing, and we really didn't know if the thing worked. But to our credit, and to yours, because we're a volunteer-supported station, we brought the old thing and hooked it up and tried to see if we could find anything. Nobody else at the press center had any sort of Geiger counter. They didn't have anything. It appeared as though they didn't even question whether or not there would be radioactivity in the area. Did we find out? No. But did we ask? Yes. All right, so we hooked the thing up, and guess what happened? Everybody was asking us. That's right. Reporters from all over the press corps were coming up to us and interviewing us as to whether there was radioactivity in the air. And what could we say? Check this funky old thing out. We don't know. All right. So that's the story about our Geiger counter and what we tried to do for you. But let's talk about Attorney Greg Cafori. He spoke with KBOO's Lisa Loving last week about PGE's history of secrecy in Trojan's construction.
There were about 9 plants, Westinghouse plants, that had the same defect that Trojan did, and that is the steam generators began to leak before their life expectancy had been reached. So the other 8 plants that had that problem, they just took out the steam generators and paid $250 million and put in new ones. With Trojan, they had to face the likelihood that the plant was going to be closed anyway by citizen action. So when it came time to decide whether to spend the money and try to keep the plant going or to just give up, they gave up. But everybody else that had the same problem that didn't have a citizens movement against them went ahead and fixed them and ran them.
Here, now, just for the record, Bechtel also was contracted to build Trojan, right?
Bechtel built the plant, the physical plant. Westinghouse built the internal components, including the steam generators, which crapped out early.
Now, this stuff is important because, in the end, it turned out there were so many defects in construction. Do you have a minute to talk about?
Sure.
I mean, there were many.
Oh, yes.
In fact, even at some point when they tried to fix some, they made them worse.
The plant was built with about half the earthquake capacity that it was designed to have. And this was discovered and concealed for some period of time. And then in 1977, they owned up to it, and the plant was closed for 9 months while structural repairs were made. There was a lawsuit then between PGE and Bechtel over who was going to pay for the shutdown. And the two parties, as the case approached trial, went to the federal judge and said, what we've learned about how this plant was built should never see the light of day. And we can settle this case, but only if Your Honor signs a gag order saying that anybody that has anything to do with this case or ever learns anything about the case, any of the facts that came out in discovery in this case, if they ever tell anybody what they know, they'll go to jail for it. And that order was signed by the judge. In fact, a succession of judges signed very similar orders. So the entire file, if you go to look up PGE versus Bechtel at the federal courthouse, you'll see a file that's got about two pieces of paper in it saying none of your business. But the heart of the secret file was ultimately, some 5 years later, leaked to Lloyd Marbette. And it showed that that PGE's engineers, a firm called Priest Gowdy out of San Francisco, a world-class firm, looked at Trojan and said that basically if you sneezed, it would fall over, and that it was completely misdesigned, and so that no one could even calculate what kind of earthquake resistance it would have, but that it wouldn't be good. And so Lloyd Marbette and I went to all the various regulatory agencies and said, time to investigate the cover-up and time to investigate whether this plant is safe enough to withstand a significant earthquake, and everybody refused to look at it. And then we learned not too long thereafter that, unbeknownst to anybody at the time the plant was built, we live in the most menacing earthquake zone in the world. We have the Cascadia subduction zone just off the Oregon coast, and every 300 years or so, it gives way and gives us earthquakes as large as the planet knows how to generate.
Okay, one last question. What's the weirdest, wackiest fact or the most ironic thing about Trojan, its history, blowing it up, the fact that it's so central to The Simpsons, any of that? What's your favorite wacky Trojan fact?
The when Bechtel was building Trojan, they had a great team of nuclear engineers, but they ran out of them because they were building nuclear plants all over the country. So by the time they got to Trojan, with this little backwater utility, you know, PGE, they didn't have any nuclear engineers to design and build the plant. So they turned to what in the secret testimony was called the engineering equivalent of Kelly girls. And that's who built Trojan. The first guy who was assigned the job was named Muhammad Ali. And he you know, got them up to the point where they're about ready to start pouring concrete, and somebody said, by the way, can we see your earthquake calculations showing that this thing will stand up? And he said, earthquake calculations? He hadn't done any. And so he was fired, and they brought in a guy named James Edmonds, another guy from, you know, the engineering equivalent of Kelly girls. And Edmonds designed the plant. And the when he was later questioned during the PGE Bechtel litigation, that you know, where they kept that file secret for years and years and years until it was leaked, his testimony was a great eye opener. He was asked by one of the lawyers for PGE, Mr. Edmonds, prior to designing the Trojan nuclear power plant, had you ever before designed a nuclear plant? And he said, well, no. I said, well, had you ever designed an entire structure for earthquake resistance? He said, no, I don't believe I have. Well, prior to designing the Trojan nuclear power plant, had you ever before designed an entire structure? He says, no, not an entire structure. I said, well, had you ever designed a composite wall for earthquake resistance? He said, no. I said, well, prior to designing the Trojan nuclear power plant, sir, had you ever before designed a wall? And James Edmonds said, no.
That was Jim Gaffori with interviewed by Lisa Loving earlier this week. Last week, KBOO reporter Stephanie Potter spoke with former Portlander Mary Olson, Southeast Office of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, about nuclear safety issues for this past generation.
My name is Mary Olson, and I work for Nuclear Information and Resource Service. I'm the director of the Southeast Office based in Asheville, North Carolina. We're a non-government organization, and we were founded 28 years ago by people in communities where they were targeted for new nuclear power reactors, like is happening today. Only at that time in the 70s, grassroots activists did not really have national organizations to work with, and so we were founded to be a clearinghouse and networking information resource for people opposing new nuclear power reactors and fighting nuclear waste dumps. Well, every nuclear reactor is basically an atomic bomb with the clutch in. There's still an argument going as to whether the Chernobyl accident was a chemical explosion or a physical, as in atomic, explosion. The sighting of a reactor in the terribly geologically active and unstable area like the Cascades and the Columbia River Basin is just ludicrous. I was in Portland, Oregon in 1980 when Mount St. Helens blew up, and it was not an idle fear that perhaps the flows of mud and debris from that explosion could have backed up the Columbia River and caused flooding at the flooding at the Trojan reactor. And those facilities are not designed to handle that kind of circumstance. The first and foremost vulnerability of every single nuclear reactor in the world is that they depend on off-site power for the running of everything on site, like the cooling for the reactor core. And all of the types of vulnerabilities that you mentioned are not that unusual, but they could be catastrophic in the case of Trojan sitting there in such a seismically active, volcanically active area with a major river right there. Anytime you have miles and miles and miles of pipes, which every single large nuclear reactor in the United States does have, and each reactor was built in a unique configuration, leakage becomes not just a maintenance issue, it becomes a safety issue over time. And when the major pipes start having embrittlement from the intense heat and radioactivity, this is not a small matter, and we are seeing failure of pipes that the industry said would never fail. The Trojan reactor was thankfully closed before it entered very far into what you call the end of the bathtub curve. But every type of mechanical system has what you call a bathtub curve. You have failures early in the life of the system, and then they work out the kinks if it's not catastrophic, and they get it going pretty good. And then just like an automobile, towards the end of its life, you start having a lot more breakdowns and a lot more problems again. And Trojan was definitely entering the second half of its operative life and into that second half of the bathtub curve. Thankfully, it was closed before any of those terrible things happened.
A few moments ago, Greg Gaffori spoke of Lloyd Marbet and his work to shut down Trojan nuclear plant. We are lucky to have Mr. Marbet in the studio tonight. Lloyd, what can you tell? What are your thoughts about the shutdown of Trojan and the implosion yesterday?
Well, Andy, I did a press conference with Greg Gaffori on Sunday after the tower came down, and I put together a statement, which, if it's all right, I'll just share with everyone, because it really covers all the ground on at least my perception of what we just went through. There's been a great deal of attention focused on the implosion of the Trojan cooling tower as Portland General Electric continues to erase the evidence of what they have long perpetrated in our midst. I hope that the media will continue to expose the economic and environmental costs of the nuclear fuel cycle, along with our desperate need for a sane energy policy, massively committed to conservation and renewable energy resources, laying the foundation for a sustainable economy. We should also never forget that when the Trojan cooling tower came down, all of the nuclear waste produced at Trojan remains on site, still with no place to go. The reactor vessel and the steam generators hurriedly removed will remain buried in the ground at Hanford, hopefully guarded from biological intrusion for thousands of years. The hidden costs of radiation exposure to workers and the public will remain painful stories of suffering, most likely never to be told. And the price of this legacy will continue to be paid in our electricity rates and by those who will come after us, reaping little benefit from a technology that is yet to be held fully accountable. I suppose by now it's no secret that I didn't support the cooling tower at Trojan coming down. It should have been left as a monument to the failure of this technology and the arrogance of those who promoted it. It should have become a living testament to what has been best described by Amory Lovins, who I have great respect for, and he said, and I quote, "When the history of the nuclear controversy comes to be written, those who killed nuclear technology will be seen to have been its most avid promoters, who systematically mistook hope for facts, advocacy for analysis, expertise for infallibility, engineering for politics, public relations for truth, and the people for fools." Yet, like so many aspects of nuclear power, that's the end of Amory's statement, by the way. Yet, like so many aspects of nuclear power, there is much we cannot undo. I propose that an alternate memorial should be constructed at Trojan, consisting of a replica of the nuclear plant with the names of all those who stood in opposition, suffering defeat after defeat, only to persevere and ultimately be proven right when Portland General Electric finally threw in the towel and permanently closed this nuclear plant down. Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." At Trojan, this phenomena of a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens was experienced many times over. It was all the people being hauled off to jail in all of the occupations that took place over the years. It was all the people who testified at legislative and licensing hearings. It was the lawyers who litigated on the various problems that occurred at the plant. It was all the people who gathered signatures and signed petitions year after year. It was all the people who freely gave of their talents and resources. It was quite simply all the people who cared. As I approach the end of my life, the greatest honor I have had was to stand with you in a common struggle dictated from the heart by reverence for life and a concern for those who would come after us. I don't know whether the Trojan story will ever be told, but I do know that everything we stood for needs to be reaffirmed in the face of what we now confront in the war in Iraq, in a foreign policy based on preemptive war with the use of nuclear weapons, in a revived public relations effort to build so-called redesigned nuclear plants in response to global warming, and in an economic ideology that continues to assert its destructive control over life by promoting growth for the sake of growth and earning a profit at any cost. Rather than coming to terms with ourselves, confronting the way in which we destructively consume the planet and condemn future generations to the externalities of our blindness and deceit, we are instead being asked to embrace one technological fix after another. So as we pull the Trojan cooling tower down in this symbolic display of accomplishment, let us now rededicate ourselves to that greatness of spirit which honors the well-being of our children's 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 children, and which preserves the sacredness of the life support systems that sustain and care for all sentient beings, providing us with an endless opportunity to experience stewardship, compassion, and in love in everything that we might do and in all that we might become.
Thank you, Lloyd.
You're welcome.
PG repeatedly claimed yesterday that the Trojan plant was shut down voluntarily. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it was shut down voluntarily in the sense that we were unable to shut it down through the initiative process. We lost all three of the elections that we participated in when we gathered hundreds of thousands of signatures year after year. It was voluntary in the sense that we were outmaneuvered in the legislature year after year in the 17 years of that plant's operation. It was voluntary in the sense that PGE managed to overcome the court challenges, the regulatory licensing proceeding challenges, and so forth year after year. But in the end, when PGE made this so-called volunteer decision, I'm sure that when they sat in the room and they were thinking about reopening this plant, they knew that out there in the community was a dedicated group of people who were unwilling to stand down. We never stood down. All of us, in one way or another, never stood down. We were always a presence in one manner or another, and that ultimately, I think, had to enter into the equation when they said finally, gee, you know, we've lied to them year after year in the elections. Maybe what we ought to do now is just get out from under it, even though we told them, by the way, 3 months prior to their decision to shut it down voluntarily, that if the plant was shut down, there would be brownouts and blackouts, that, you know, we'd be without power, that there would be, you know, they'd have to raise the rates, which they do anyway, but they didn't after they shut down Trojan immediately, and proved really an embarrassment to themselves.
As one of the chronologies that I'm looking at here said that the governor of Oregon at the time, Barbara Roberts, was finally coming around to your side.
Yeah, that's right. What had happened was I kind of start telling this story in 92 in after the election in November. You know, we lost again. Every time though, we came back, we gained public support, but never enough to get the majority. We were close. I think we had like 46% of the vote that year. So about 20 days after the election was over, after they told us this plant was absolutely safe and so forth, they sprung a leak in steam generator B. And it was a significant leak. It was leaking radiation from the primary coolant system into the secondary system, which includes the steam generators and the turbine. And so they had to shut the plant down. And they immediately went into repairs, and they were talking about restarting the plant. But then about 2 weeks after that, a scientist by the name of Robert Pollard, who worked for the Union of Concerned Scientists, received some documents that showed that a year prior to this, when they were looking at when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was looking at the problem with the steam generators at Trojan, there was a dissent that was taking place within the agencies from the scientists that were involved in this review, who felt strongly that this plant should be shut down, that it was an accident waiting to happen, literally. And so what was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's response to that? They suppressed the dissent. And so none of us knew what was actually occurring behind closed doors. So Pollard, when he received this material, immediately released it to the public. Now, when we got copies of that, he sent it out to us. We immediately sent it to all the regulatory agencies. Now, in my long years as an anti-nuclear activist, I had felt that before I would be willing to commit civil disobedience, I would have to be able to say that I tried all other avenues first, right? So I immediately petitioned the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the state's Energy Facility Siting Council, director of the Department of Energy, even the president. I mean, sent letters to everyone saying, listen, you know, this has gone on long enough. What we need to do here is we need to have a hearing in order to review the assertions of safety that this utility is made over and over again, and really see whether or not we've got a significant problem here. I mean, there seems to be enough evidence now that's available that warrants that kind of investigation. Everybody turned us down. That's when I, and in the beginning, there were seven people total. I and six other people went to the gates of Trojan and stood in the path of the workers coming in and got arrested. And after they basically wanted to get us out of jail and wanted us to sign these agreements that we'd never go back, which I refused to do, they let us out again. And then we went back. I think there was like 30 of us. There were more people now. The concern was spreading and more people were seeing the documentation because we were doing our best to get it out into the community. At that point, they threw me in jail in contempt of court for 2 weeks. And in the meantime, people were lobbying now. People that were becoming aware of this were sending letters to the governor and to the Department of Energy and so forth saying, come on, these people aren't, saying that this thing's unsafe. They're just saying, let's have a hearing to see what the safety's all about. And lo and behold, somewhere along the way, it got upstairs to Barbara, I guess, and she basically led to the decision to hold the hearing. And as soon as that was announced, PG threw in the towel. And now there's another, since we're on this track, I guess I might as well at least go up to the final chapter on it. Now, we all had trespassing charges against us. I thought that the moment they announced the plant was shut down, why the hell would they want to, prosecute us? But they wanted to prosecute us. And so we meaning the 30-some-odd people that were now being processed through the courts, even though there wasn't a nuclear plant that was going to operate, we were forced to appear in court, and we decided that we would make a choice of evils argument. In Oregon, there's a law in the books that says, if you see some harm being done, you can commit acts. Like, for instance, if I see a fire through a window of a house and I want to go up and kick the door in, well, guess what? I just, forced entry. I mean, God knows how much I could get for that. And especially being an activist. I mean, they'd love to throw the book at activists. But anyway, the bottom line was that we were doing this choice of evils argument, and we were requesting all the records on, the operation of the nuclear plant. Finally, we were going to hopefully get to see what really was going on behind the scenes. And PGE and the district attorney fought against us vociferously. They did not want that door to open. And we had recused two judges. They had to recuse themselves because they had been part of the prosecution team for the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance occupiers, so they had to go. I mean, they obviously had a problem. And they brought in a judge from Tillamook County. And this judge was an honest judge. And he basically granted us our motion to look at the documentation. And I've never seen anything like this before. I was in the courtroom when this happened. I'm watching this go down. PGE's attorney's in the courtroom. He gets up. He walks over to the district attorney, whispers in the district attorney's ear. The district attorney stands up and says, "We're dropping the charges." I mean, I wish I had that kind of power. I wish I could walk up to a prosecutor, whisper in his ear, and have things go away. I mean, it was just amazing.
Can you tell us a little bit about the push for these so-called new nuclear plants? And with the track record of the NRC suppressing information, I mean, how does that look going forward from here?
Well, I am terribly disappointed to see this, what appears to be new public relations effort on behalf of nuclear power plants. We've got new reactor designs. Okay, they're safe now. And there's lots of interviews going on the various media stations with Jose Reyes down in Corvallis at Oregon State University. There's a number of people that have been working on these new reactor designs.
Are you saying they're safe?
Or they're saying they're safe.
Oh, they're saying they're safe. Oh, absolutely. They got all passive systems now. Everything will shut down. And I got two responses to that. If they're so safe, I assume we no longer need the Price-Anderson Act, which is taxpayers subsidizing any accidents that happen at nuclear power plants, right? I mean, after all, they're so safe, we don't need to renew the Price-Anderson Act and prop up this industry anymore. Second thing that I'd say is this. I'm unaware of any reactor design that is going to survive an endless war of terrorism. I mean, we almost, in 9/11, instead of having the two towers come down, it's my understanding that the people that were flying those planes had considered running one of those planes into a nuclear power plant. If that's the case, it would have been a tragedy that lives far longer in our lives in, as far as its impacts and increased people suffering from the response to that, because I don't think even the new reactor designs are going to withstand that kind of reality. I mean, we live in an unstable world, and I don't think nuclear power brings justice to the world. I don't think oil or fossil fuels are bringing justice to the world. But I do think that if we live in a sustainable energy economy or a sustainable economy that's powered by renewable energy, we can bring justice to the world, because we decentralize and people begin to control their lives more than the way we've got it now. So, that's basically my response to all this hoopla about how, oh boy, we got, take a look at my my new baseball card here and the engineering design that'll do it all.
All righty. Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I hope listeners out, there's another thing I think that listeners need to realize, underlying all these problems, I have been working very hard on initiatives for campaign finance reform, initiative number 8, initiative number 37, and we're close to getting the signatures that we need to bring campaign finance reform to Oregon. Now, why do I bring this up when we're talking about nuclear power? Well, as a nuclear activist and one that felt that I had to try all the avenues, before I finally went to the gates of the plant, I spent a long time down in the legislature watching the utilities buy out legislators to ultimately get what they wanted time and time and time and time again. We need to take back democracy. Ultimately, all the problems that we confront in the inequities that we confront are in some way or another attached to that theme. And I really encourage people, if you will, to go to www.fairelections.net. That's www.fairelections.net, and get copies of these petitions. We've got till July the 8th to get the signatures that we need. And also, there's a toll-free number for you out there that don't have access to a computer, and that's 1-800-939-8011. That's 1-800-939-8011. And help put this on the ballot so that we can begin to take back democracy, because I think if democracy worked, we would have a far saner energy policy. We would have health care for all. Lord knows how we can address the problems that we confront in our community if we had a fair shake in the process. Level the playing field. Please help put Initiative 8 and 37 on the ballot.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Five, four, three, two, one.
message on extension 203.
Hi there. You're listening to KBOO FM in Portland on 90.7 on your dial. Obviously, that was a technical occurrence that an undocumented technical occurrence we did not expect. So, apparently a CD was acting up. Appeared to be a homeburn CD that didn't quite work the way we would expect. So we're about ready to do something else to get this show back on. And so we're ready to go now to production 2. Thank you for your patience. This is KBOO.
You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast are Lisa Lewis and Andy Seaton. Tonight's audio editors are Noah Eaton, John Delderfield, Lisa Loving, Lisa Lewis, and Andy Seaton. Special thanks to reporters Stephanie Potter, Spencer Raymond, Rabia Yeaman, Jonathan Delderfield, Andy Seaton, and me, Lisa Lewis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving.
And we also want to thank Mr. Lloyd Marbet for coming in and telling us what's really going on in the universe. And I really support his idea about bringing back democracy into the real world. And coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor are the host for the Abe and Joe Show. Their topics are animal rights and the many developing stories around the Bush administration. At 9, Between the Covers with Ed Goldberg interviews Mark Kurlansky about his book, The Big Oyster, A History of New York City Through the Bivalve Eye. And 9:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is Jan Elliott, creator of the daily dedicated comic strip, The Stone Soup. At 10, Parfuggering speaks with Stefan Zalenga of the American Monetary Institute about monetary reform. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, hear about the female odd couple from Integrity Productions for an Asian Pacific American Heritage Month with the story of a frontier woman, Lalu Nathoi, otherwise known as Polly Bemis in Idaho. And, of course, at 11, it's Democracy Now! So thank you for listening tonight for our Trojan special. This is KBOO Evening News.